Hey guys, welcome to the Gay Footballers Podcast. I'm your host, Adam McCabe, and I am so excited to finally give you guys this podcast. We've got the first episode ready to go, and I just can't believe this is finally happening. We've hit many bumps in the road, many stalls, and I just knew after holding on to this project for 2 years now, that this year was the year I really had to put a lot more effort and time into it. And I'm so excited because here we go. Here's the start. Just a bit of a refresher. Every couple of weeks, I am going to sit down with someone in the football world, or the soccer world as we call it in the US. And we're going to have a 30 to 45 minute conversation. And these individuals I'm speaking to, most of them identify as LGBTQ, or they are an ally of the LGBTQ community. Every once in a while, I'm going to insert someone or something that really interests me as a gay footballer, but a lot of the discussions are going to cover the world of sports, culture of sports, sports and society, and the goal of this is really to show people around the world what individuals are doing to make sports a more inclusive place and really just shine light on people who are doing amazing work in sports. Again, the focus is really going to be on football because that's my life. That's my wheelhouse. But every once in a while, we may switch it up to keep things interesting. So before we begin, I would love for all the listeners to subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform they're listening on. So if that's Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, wherever you're listening to, please hit that subscribe button. This is going to help us increase our numbers up the chart, increase the listens, and really be able to spread the word about the podcast and really be able to connect people. You can find us on all social media platforms. We're on Facebook and Instagram at The Gay Footballers Podcast. We are on Twitter at TGFpod. And go ahead, give those a like, give those a follow so you can be up to date with all the new episodes and anything, any kind of news that's coming on from the podcast. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can reach out to us at thegayfootballerspodcast@gmail.com. Again, without your support, without the listens, you know, we really wouldn't be here. So feel free to share to your friends. Feel free to reach out to us if you think there'd be someone great for the podcast to interview, or if you'd like to collaborate, get in touch with us. We always love to hear from you guys. So when I was deciding who to put on for this first episode, it was actually quite an easy decision for me. In 2017, I was very fortunate enough to be interviewed by John Holmes of Sky Sports in the United Kingdom. And he had heard of my story of being a closeted footballer in the middle of the English pyramid, trying to fight my way up the English football ladder, playing semi-professional and professional soccer with Bradford City. And he reached out to me and we had a great conversation. And he had an amazing story that he posted about me on Sky Sports. And it's just a full circle moment, really. I felt like it'd be appropriate to interview him because he's really pushed me to give back and to be an advocate and also to use my platform for better. And I really appreciate John for his collaboration and just everything he's done for me. So in early February, I was very fortunate enough to fly to England and be a part of a conference put on by Just a Ball Game, where I was speaking at Wembley Stadium, really covering issues with homophobia and transphobia in football. And at this conference, I met a lot of amazing people, and John Holmes was there, and he introduced me to some amazing people. And in fact, the first 9 to 10 podcast interviews you're going to hear are from my time in London, interviewing people in and around the football world there. And it was just an amazing experience because I really want to take the ideas and the things they're doing over in England, which a lot of people consider the home of football, and just try to bring them back here to the US and try to implement these ideas. I'm not going to talk too much about John because that's what the interview's about, but John is the homepage editor for Sky Sports Digital. Something also John has done is he has created the Sports Media LGBT Plus Network. It's a great community for people who are working in sport to come together, bounce off ideas, collaborate with each other, and just to hear what's going on, what people are doing, and to really support one another. So I'm going to quit talking. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce John Holmes through our interview. Here we go. So guys, I'm really, really excited today for our guest. This is kind of, the way I look at it, one of the guys who kind of started or helped me start this journey into this work of advocacy and really looking to see how I can help other people in the LGBT community. Today we have on the podcast Mr. John Holmes.
Hello. Hi.
How are you doing today?
Very well. How are you?
Doing good. I know this has been like a long time coming. We've spoken via email, via phone, but to meet in person is pretty exciting. And again, I'm just really happy to connect, especially because in my opinion, you're one of the leading, if not one of the top, or the top kind of journalists or activists in the world of football and media, and really trying to change the standard and the image and the picture of the representation in this community. And one of the reasons why I started this was, again, to highlight people who are in the football world, but kind of need more recognition, and you're definitely leading that charge. So, again, very excited to be here, and thanks for everything you do. But, yeah, definitely happy for this podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. But thanks to you, and like it's, you know, stories like yours, which are so important for, you know, spreading the word that there are LGBT people in football and are thriving in football and have had, you know, lots of different experiences. So it's very much a storytelling exercise. You know, we get people like yourself who come forward and are willing to share their truth. So it does make a huge difference.
And for people who may not know this, John works for Sky Sports, but he's also the one who wrote one of the, the nicest, I don't know, well-written, everything. He wrote a very nice article about me and kind of my journey through being scared to come out, facing mental illness while I was playing at a high level, and kind of re-falling in love with football again. And I will always be grateful for John, because till this day, that story will stay on all my social media accounts and like the header, because it's such a great story, but also it's he's a tremendous writer, so grateful for John for kind of unleashing that story. And I'm going to ask, I don't even remember where you first saw it or how we first connected. Do you remember how you saw that story?
I think we spoke in February of 2017, I think it was. And that was, 2 years ago this month.
Yeah.
And that was Football v Homophobia month here in the UK and LGBT History Month here in the UK as well. So I was looking for stories to cover. And I think I must have read an interview that you'd done, I can't remember the name of the website now, something with M, was it? It's completely passed me by, but it was one of the first interviews that you'd done with a US website, and that's kind of just how I became aware of the story, really. I think I'd seen it shared on social, became aware, and then I was, you know, particularly fascinated by the fact that you were playing in West Yorkshire, which is where I was living for many years, and I knew a lot of the places that you were talking about, some of the teams that you'd played for up there, and I was just kind of like really aware that people might have read about this story in the States, but here in the UK was where it was particularly important to get that story out there because of the locations and the teams that you played for and your experience of English football being, you know, a gay man, and there aren't very many stories like that we get to tell, so it was really important to share that, and you know, people really did connect with it and really empathized with it, so it was really good.
Again, if you haven't had the chance to read the story, I will make sure to post it on the link with this podcast. But again, I encourage everyone who listens to this podcast to check out all the things that John covers for Sky. Again, tremendous writer, and even more so, he deals with all my questions. And if I ask him to edit something, he is very nice and will take the time to look at it, but he's really well known in this space and he's got great connections. So again, thank you so much for everything you've done for me. We will shift gears here, and I mean, I always like to learn kind of the basic history of people I'm interviewing with. I mean, where did your love for sports or for football come? Did you play growing up? Did you love journalism? Kind of give me that whole background story of how you got into football and subsequently journalism.
Yeah, I was really late to football relatively. Like, there was no one in my family that had a real passion for football. My dad was a cricket fan, cricket mad. So it wasn't until I got into my kind of mid-teens, and a couple of my friends were big fans. I have one of my very, very best friends is an Arsenal season ticket holder and has been Arsenal crazy for as long as I've known him. And we were living in the southwest of England growing up and at school there. And yeah, just slowly kind of began to learn more about the game and the teams. And I started supporting Plymouth Argyle, which is my local team down in the southwest. Started going to games now and again with friends and just kind of grew from there. So I was kind of a late starter really. I was like 16 years old, around about the time some of your listeners may remember, like Euro 96, which was a huge tournament here in England. First time we'd hosted the European Championships, and you know, we got to the semi-finals and you know, football's coming home, it all stems from that tournament. So that was a really kind of pivotal time. And yeah, I'd always been really into English literature and writing. So those two kind of married up, and I wanted to be a football journalist. I wanted to study journalism at university. So I had several unis that I went and looked around and went to Liverpool and just fell in love with the city, fell in love with just everything about it. I mean, it's, for those of your listeners that have ever been there, it's a great place. The buzz of the city, the fact that football plays such a huge role in just everyday life. I mean, you can't go there and not be kind of connected to it in some way. So I was very fortunate. I got to go to a game, like a nighttime game with my mum, Liverpool, Newcastle, Michael Owen scored. And yeah, everything about it just kind of locked into place. So I went there to study and studied journalism and became a football journalist.
So we'll revisit this topic at the end, but when you were studying journalism, did you have like an apprenticeship, or did you have, I guess what we would say in America, like an internship? Like, I know a big part of working in this industry is it's super competitive, but people like to see that you have the quote unquote experience of writing and interviewing players and being in that environment. Did you have a journalism job while studying, or did you just right out of uni, hey, I'm working for Sky? Like, how did that kind of transition work?
Yeah, it was kind of several parts of it really. So I was studying journalism, so you know, there were opportunities to do various bits of sports journalism as part of my course. Started writing for the student paper. This is kind of a fairly well-worn route, I think, for people. Became sports editor of the student paper. Went off and did work experience, and through connections that I had and through friends, I was able to do that at a football website called teamtalk.com, which was one of several kind of startup businesses. It was one of the more successful ones. It actually kind of progressed from premium rate phone lines, which was quite a big thing in the UK sort of in the 90s. That's how a lot of people kind of got their football news before the internet really took off, and then was moving more into digital spaces, so through the website and what have you. So I went there to do WorkX. When I finished uni, they offered me a job full time, so I moved from Liverpool to Leeds to start working there full time, and yeah, just progressed up on the football desk until around about the end of the noughties, the end of the 2000s, when Sky came along and bought out the whole business.
For our US listeners, I compare Sky Sports to our ESPN. I mean, it's the major sports network media channel here. I mean, can you talk about working for such a huge company? I mean, like Sky Sports?
Yeah, so things have like evolved a lot like over the years. I mean, digital media is changing so much so rapidly. Sky Sports came into being in like the early 90s as a satellite broadcaster, a subscription sports channel, the first in the UK, and really made its name by making a huge play for Premier League football, or Premiership football as it was then, and won the exclusive rights to broadcast that in the UK. And that kind of has had a really transformative effect on English football. the amount of money that has started to trickle into the game, and it has just got bigger and bigger and bigger as the years go by, as everyone knows the Premier League story. So as far as I'm concerned, I've worked on the digital side of the sports business for many years now, and was working in Leeds for many years, and then moved down to London probably about 5 years ago to take the role that I'm in now. And yeah, we are the biggest in Europe now in terms of digital sports media network. You know, we are well connected through Italy, Germany, through the bigger Sky business. Sky here is, as you say, it's similar to ESPN in terms of the sports, but we are now owned by Comcast. So we have very close ties with them. That all happened in the last 12 months. So we do feel part of a much bigger organization. And Sky obviously does broadband, it does TV packages, it does every sort of thing to keep people connected in lots of different ways, and lots of entertainment and sport as well. So it's a big operation.
And can you state your title and break down, I mean, I know what you do for Sky, but break down for the listeners what goes into digital work.
Yeah, so I'm homepage editor at Sky Sports Digital. So I manage and run and handle content for all our digital channels. So that's web, it's apps, we have different digital spaces on, for example, Sky Q, which is our set-top box. People might equate that a bit more with cable, I think, in the States, but it's one of our platforms now as well. And I also manage the output team, so all the content that gets produced across Sky Sports for the digital comes through our department and gets checked over and managed by our team. So that's a team of sub-editors, and I lead that team. And the other part of the work that I do, and I have done in a lot more of in the last 3 years, is around Sky's commitment to inclusion. And through a partnership that we have with the LGBT charity Stonewall here in this country, which is called Rainbow Laces, which some of your listeners may have heard of, we are the media partner on that campaign. And so I help to manage that relationship, and I manage all the content that supports that campaign that we produce.
So we will dive into a bit more of that later. But I really want to talk about sports journalism here for a second. I think people dream and fantasize of the luxuries, and they see the fun aspects of sports journalism. We're here on a Sunday doing this, and I know you're about to go into work. So I want you to talk about the work that goes into being a sports journalist. And I know it's maybe not as glamorous at times, and here you are working on the weekend. So kind of speak about that lifestyle as a sports journalist.
Yeah, I mean, sport is played at all times, all weathers, all around the world. So, you know, if you're in sports journalism, depending on what sport it is you cover, you know, you can find yourself, you know, working what would be deemed to be unsociable hours. It's certainly not like a regular job, but obviously you're in it for the passion. And when you're part of a huge company like Sky Sports, obviously you get access to a lot more things, and we have a lot of broadcasting rights, and you know, we obviously have big platforms where we have, you know, a huge amount of users. So that kind of elevates it to a level that's particularly exciting. I suppose, you know, if you get into the industry, it just comes mainly from a love of sport. Or not everyone has to be a great writer now. I mean, we have really skilled people in lots of different ways: social media, digital producers, whether it's broadcasting, podcasting. There's so many elements to it that make up the bigger sports media picture. So there's so many avenues and ways for people to get involved in the industry, but it is super competitive. And, you know, people just have to really be able to marry that love for sport with the skills to share that love with other people. And that's the secret to it.
And to circle back around, any kind of advice for the aspiring sports journalist if they want to work for Sky or any other big media outlet in sports? What would be your kind of, you need to do A, B, C, D if you want a chance?
I think the most important thing is just to be to consume like so much yourself, and make sure you, for example, if there's a certain employer where you really want to work, you need to know their platform like inside out. You need to be a huge user of it. You need to know all the good points about it, all the points that maybe aren't so good, and where you think you can improve things. you know, I think what employers are really looking for is people with kind of the analytical skills as well as the talents to be able to recognize where there's a gap in the market and to offer something that would fill that gap. That's the route in, I think, that a lot of people, sometimes they miss that because they think, well, I can do kind of lists of like top 10 players on things, or I can write something about Arsenal's transfer strategy. Well, that's all well and good. I'm sure that's interesting, but there's nothing particularly original about that. And there's almost always going to be someone who's doing it better than you are. So even if it's not something that's hugely high profile, try and find those stories that haven't been told before. Go and speak to the people. You know, you've got to put in the legwork still. And editors and, you know, senior leaders in sport will always be interested in something that's new. So you just got to keep finding what's new and be prepared to tell those stories and put in the hard yards to do it.
I mean, first of all, great advice. And something you touched on earlier is how you're kind of this LGBTQ arm or leader within Sky Sports and the partnerships. And I know earlier last year, or I forgot what point of last year, but you started, you know, this Sports Media Plus network for LGBTQ members. And again, when I think of John, I think of someone who's very well connected in this industry, and he's pushing the boundaries, but also trying to bring people together. Can you speak about this kind of network or this initiative you've kind of brought together?
Yeah, so through the kind of the journalism and the work that we've done at Sky Sports, as you say, kind of meet lots more people, you know, who have similar goals, activists or journalists or, you know, various charity workers, you know, lots of different ways that people are involved in advocacy work. And there's always been kind of an undercurrent, I think, certainly in the last 20 years or so, that one of the real problems in terms of LGBT inclusion in football, but in sport in general, is the role of the media and what role the media plays. Does it focus too much on the negative? Does it kind of skirt around the positive stories because maybe they're not quite as exciting as the negative ones? How do we, you know, present LGBT athletes to the world in terms of our newspaper coverage, in terms of our media coverage? So there always, quite often, was this pivotal role that the media was playing. And actually the media didn't really seem to be too heavily involved in those conversations. We were always slightly outside the group that was talking about it. So I really wanted to make sure that the media, or the sports media as a whole, was more central to those conversations. And the only real way to do that was to form an organisation, form a network, you know, that could put out its stated aims and objectives, you know, to make sure that our industry, as much as sport, so the media industry as much as sport, is inclusive and is seeking to break down those barriers which prevent people from feeling that they can be their authentic selves in the workplace or in their team or in their club. So, you know, every industry is on its own kind of LGBT inclusion journey, and the media is no different. I think people's perceptions of the media, certainly outside of sports, is that, oh, it's great and you can be gay and work here and there and it's fine, because the media is seen as being a very kind of liberal, you know, well-rounded kind of industry. Whereas sports is sometimes, apart from that, sports media, sometimes it doesn't really sort of kind of works in its own way. There's an age-old expression in British journalism that sports is the toy department of journalism. So it's not seen to be quite as serious as like Heart News or the rest of it. Whereas actually, you know, sports media is big business. It's a huge sell for any media publisher. That sports audience is crucial. So we need to be having these conversations as much as any other part of the media. So that was really why the network was founded. And I'd met kind of other journalists who were LGBT in the course of the work that I was doing. And there was a feeling that, you know, stronger together, like, you know, we bond together, we try and find ways to help each other. And we're just one part of a much bigger inclusion picture. So BAME, people in sports journalism, are underrepresented. Women in football and women in sports media are, again, underrepresented. So collectively, we all shared kind of overall aims and ambitions to make, you know, workplaces, you know, healthier environments. So we do a lot of collaborative work, and we make sure those conversations are being had in a responsible way.
Yeah, I mean, I love getting these emails from John, again, because I just learning about what other people in the sports media world are doing and who identify as LGBTQ. It's great for me to just know you know, what people's passions are and what their, you know, projects are, and then I can see if they align or if we can collaborate. So again, I thank you for kind of leading the way with that. And something I want to draw on that you just talked about, I was at, as you know, the Tottenham Newcastle game the other day at Wembley, and in the sports or the press media area, I did see, you know, I think it was 3 or 4 females, but in the press conference with the coaches afterwards, I think I only saw one female. And I think to your point, if I looked around the room, it was predominantly, you know, white men or white males. And I even think you may have written an article kind of about the diversity of sports media. And I think it's, again, to your point, something that we've got to also examine. And so, again, I appreciate you kind of leading that charge and also pointing it out and questioning it, because that's how we get it to change.
Yeah, and, you know, people like myself, we're not lone voices like shouting in the wilderness anymore. There's lots of people that are really committed to the same goals. And so you don't feel like you're constantly fighting a battle now. It feels very much like we're on the path towards, you know, the arc sort of does bend upwards, and it's really satisfying work, and you meet so many interesting people with unique kind of experiences, and you get to, you know, to find out, learn a little bit more about their work as well. So we're very much about championing the good work that people are doing, amplifying those LGBT voices to make sure that people are heard.
Well, I guess, what is the like end game or goal vision for this group?
Yeah, well, one of the first things that was a really big target for us was to do a proper survey, I think, in our first year. So we surveyed, probably had about just under like 100 people responded, and not just LGBT people in sports media, although the majority were, but we asked, you know, people for their perceptions of the industry and their experiences within the industry. And the figures, kind of the two kind of top line figures that came back really were that just under 50% of LGBT people in sports media were either not out at all in their workplace or were out only to very close kind of friends. So that kind of, that feeling that you could be yourself at work, is clearly there's a lot of work that needs to be done there in order for those workplaces to be inclusive. And the other one was, so not just LGBT people, we asked everyone in the survey if they'd heard language or seen behaviour which they would deem to be anti-LGBT within the last couple of years. And again, about 50% or just under 50% of people said yes, they had. So again, that, and is that which has a big correlation on the first stat that I was talking about. If you're witnessing, not frequently, but occasionally, now and again, maybe just one incident really sticks in your mind and you don't forget it, that somebody says, oh, that's okay, or says something derogatory about LGBT people, then of course you're not going to want to necessarily share your own truth in that environment. So we need to make sure that we recognise that when LGBT people can be their true full selves, then they're going to perform better, they're going to achieve more, they're going to have better relationships with their colleagues and be more cooperative. And until we kind of get that mentality across the board, then there's always going to be work to do.
I'm curious to hear if you've ever been in an instant where you've been kind of at a sporting event and you have heard homophobic language yourself, or have you been abused? I'm curious to learn more about, like you said, the people who've kind of been in the sporting world and have been attacked or been kind of shamed for their sexuality. So has that ever happened to you or anyone close that you know?
So I think things are moving so rapidly, and I think you could have had, for example, a bad experience maybe like 5 years ago in sport or in sports media, and now I think it would still be seen to be relatively rare, although these incidents absolutely do still happen. And if anything, because they are maybe not as common or the attitudes are changing, they are more in focus because they are seen to be so unusual perhaps now. But it's a really delicate sort of, it's impossible to kind of pinpoint one person's experience as being like representative of everyone. I mean, whether you're geographically you're in the north of the country or you're in somewhere that's more rural as opposed to an urban environment, you know, maybe you're you work more with younger people than older people. You know, there's a huge cross-section that means that every LGBT person may have had a completely different experience in at their football club or in their workplace than someone else who's maybe only 100 miles away. You know, so there's so many different factors. For me, when I was in my early 20s, just starting out in my career, I did have a couple of experiences in the workplace, kind of things that were said or behaviours that went on. And I was very junior, and there were people that were more senior than me, and that had a big effect on me because I became conscious that this wasn't well received or wasn't truly accepted, particularly at that time. This is, say, beginning of the 21st century, so like 2002 perhaps. And so that made me kind of withdraw into myself and not want to kind of deal with that part of who I was, that part of my identity. In terms of going to sport, again, things have changed. So I support a more, a less kind of high profile club, a team that maybe pulls in crowds of about 10,000, for example, on a match day. And yeah, you would occasionally hear people shout out something from the crowd. And that still happens nowadays, but not certainly not to the extent that it used to, say, like 10, 15 years ago. But, you know, we see recently, I mean, even a couple of weekends ago, the former England defender Sol Campbell, so now manager at Macclesfield Town in League Two, you know, an away game at Cheltenham, and there were things being shouted from the crowd at him, you know, really tired old stereotypes and stupid rumours that have been around for many years. And it was, from what people were saying, it was younger people that were shouting a lot of this stuff, and that's really alarming because you think some of the attitudes are held by the older generation, but it just goes to show how influence can still reach, you know, more impressionable people. So there's still a long way to go, and it's sad that still happens, but there's definitely much more of a focus on it now and a willingness to clamp down from all parts of football, all parts of society.
Have you ever thought maybe you've been passed on a job or an opportunity because of your identity? And I follow this because I know, as you know, some of the things we write about, I wouldn't say we're pushing the line, but we're definitely trying to expose and kind of shine a light on things that organizations kind of don't want a light shined on. And I know times I feel like I've gone to interview someone and clubs have been hesitant because they're like, okay, what is his angle? And I've had to break down, like, I'm here for a good reason. I want to actually like show you guys are doing good things. And I guess, what are your thoughts on that? And have you ever had that experience where just because of your work, people are kind of hesitant to understand what you're doing or afraid that, you know, you may say something that shines them in a negative light?
So this is more in terms of the journalism that I produce?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I haven't really found that, to be honest. I mean, there's not a huge amount of people that I want to go and kind of have conversations with or have interviews with, because the LGBT visibility is still so relatively low. And a lot of the work that I do, I do kind of need people to approach me and want to kind of share their stories. So, you know, I try and make sure that, you know, that our goals are quite clear, and what we're hoping to do and what we're trying to do is very well stated. I think the fact that we, for example, the work that I do supports the work of the charity Stonewall, and their Rainbow Laces campaign is now really, really well known. It certainly has grown in terms of its stature in the last few years. So people are aware of the purpose of it and they understand the reasons for it. And it is very well supported. There's still, yeah, some negativity around the campaign, I think, from people that don't really understand the concept of visibility and why it's important. So you do get some opposition there. But certainly it's felt like a very organic process in terms of building up a body of work so that people can see that. And if they want to kind of check me out or vet me perhaps in terms of a process, then I think there's enough material there that they can see, you know, that we're coming at it from the right angle. But I mean, I suppose one of the problems we have is that maybe in terms of football particularly, a lot of this is based around rumour and conjecture as to, oh, whether someone is LGBT or not. That's really not for me to play any part in. I would not want to do an interview with someone on this topic unless they genuinely wanted to do that interview. For me, there's no benefit in terms of putting somebody up in terms of, you know, a digital media article or in front of a camera or a microphone who's reluctant to talk, because that's not going to be of any benefit to anyone. Certainly not me. I'll be wasting my time. So yeah, I think there's a genuine feeling that the stuff that we do, people are invested in it for the right reasons, and I don't feel it's a massive struggle to do that. I mean, things will come along at the time they're supposed to come along when those individuals feel ready to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like sometimes I have people who question, like, I guess what's my goal? Am I trying to write an article that's going to get a lot of clicks, or am I actually here to show, hey, you know, what you're doing outside as a football organization is actually really good? And so sometimes I feel like communication offices are kind of, you know, they want good press, and so they're very, I've got to really make sure I'm inviting someone into my home that's going to benefit me, right? And they're not going to just slash my name what have I done? I've just invited someone in who's just looking for a story. And I feel like sometimes communications office or communication departments of football clubs are kind of, they don't show their cards, and they want to make sure you check off every box before they say, yeah, come interview the coach, come interview this player, because they don't want it to stab them in the back, really.
Yeah, that's very true. And football clubs more than ever now are very protective of all their personnel. I mean, I don't really tend to put in a lot of requests to speak to people, because usually there isn't an obvious story there for me. I'm not going fishing for something that I don't know is there. So there was one recently where I did want to speak to somebody who was connected to a Premier League club. And I wasn't entirely sure that I needed necessarily to go through the media department in order to speak to that person, because it was kind of like a sidebar to the club. It wasn't quite the same. And I did get a little bit of a telling off because I hadn't gone through the correct channels. But it wasn't in a bad way. It was just kind of navigating the kind of relationships that were happening at the time. But yeah, I think people also do want to be seen to be doing good work. And they like the fact that sometimes you shine a light on some inclusion work or some kind of community work that doesn't necessarily get headlines a lot of the time. So they are appreciative of that. So I very rarely find people put up obstacles and barriers to the work that I do. I think they're, more often than not, they want to be cooperative.
So, okay, we're going to, again, shift subjects here. And I feel like not every journalist, but a lot of journalists are looking for the first openly gay player in the Premier League. And it's when people call me, I've had people call me, ask me, do you know anything? Have you heard of anyone? Has anyone like come out to you and you're holding a secret? And it actually shocks me at some of the calls I get a call from, I see someone call me from Ireland or Wales, and I'm like, who is this? And it's just someone, again, they're fishing for that story. So do you think we'll ever see an openly gay player in the Premier League, or even so in a top European league?
Will we ever see one?
I mean, ever. I know, but I guess, I mean, 5 years, 10 years, 2 years. I mean, I know it's a guess, but let me follow up with, what do you think is holding these people back? I guess that's a better way to introduce it. Why don't you think someone's come out at that level?
I think there's still a lot of tradition and history that weighs on people in football, a certain way of doing things, a feeling that if you were to in any way kind of show vulnerability, or what would be perceived to be vulnerability or weakness, that could affect you in a way that could actually devastate your whole career. I mean, you'll know, the path to the top is very, very difficult. It's super competitive, not just out on the pitch against the opposition, but within your own dressing room competing for that place on the team. Every manager and coach is having to make a decision between one player and another player frequently, in terms of giving them a new contract, allowing them to go to the next stage. Or if you're in that position, if you're the player, then you're waiting on, you know, that club to take the chance on you, and they're always going to be weighing up you against someone else. So it's an incredibly competitive industry. The pressure on players and managers and coaches has never been greater, the amount of money that's in the game now. So already, from a very basic starting point, you've got an environment where people are not going to want to kind of reveal everything about themselves. They're not going to want to show all their cards. that's just the way it is. And when you understand that, and when you begin to kind of appreciate, you know, those pressures, then it's quite easy to understand why there's no one would want to, you know, necessarily share that part of themselves with the world. But then saying that, I think there are, as we know, there are different levels of sharing. And I think what we're finding now, what we're hearing, is that actually people are sharing a little bit more about themselves within their dressing rooms, within their team environments. And again, because of the way that people understand how things have changed, about being gay or being LGBT is not necessarily a secret, but it is, for a lot of people, something that they prefer to keep, maybe not necessarily private, but within a circle of trust. I think there's that phrase, you know, a circle of trust. And John Amici says it really, really well, and I've always kind of quite often go back to this quote. He says, like, essentially what you're doing when you come out is you are taking something that's very precious to yourself, part of your identity, and you're giving it to someone else, putting it in their hands and saying, please, can you take as good a care of this as I would? And unless you have that trust, yeah, massive trust in that individual, you're taking an enormous step by sharing something that's so intrinsic to yourself with people you don't know, strangers. And if the feeling is that they could somehow use that against you, then of course the mental process of that is going to inhibit you. The dilemma we have, actually, and as you and I know, and as LGBT people who are out know, that actually, if you are able, if you do put your trust in people, you can be actually pleasantly surprised by how well that they do look after that most precious thing. And actually, the reception you get can, you know, surprise you in untold number of ways. And the effect that then has on you is that you flourish, you grow into a much fuller person. You don't have to constantly monitor what you're saying or edit your behavior or any of that. You can just begin to, you get that release. And everyone talks about a release, and, you know, very rarely, if ever, do you ever hear about someone coming out and says, I really regret it, I wish I'd come back in the closet, because they know how dark those days were. So by having these conversations, by doing the kind of work that you're doing and hopefully the work that I'm doing, and just by having these conversations much more openly, and it does tie into issues of mental health and anxiety and all these other factors that weigh on us as individuals, you know, we begin to have a fuller conversation and people feel like they can join that conversation and not be excluded from it. So that's the only way that we're going to actually create an environment where a footballer who is gay is prepared to share that with you and I or anyone else. Is it will mean that we've actually created an environment where people, where those good points that I've spoken about clearly outweigh the negative ones, and they're prepared to put everything in that box rather than worry too much about the other one.
How much do you think the media weighs on someone's mind who's maybe contemplating coming out? I mean, I know we saw just a couple weeks ago what happened with Ruben Loftus-Cheek, and let me say, or credit him for the way he did handle it, I thought was pretty admirable. Him coming out on Twitter and saying, you know, rumors aren't true, but if, you know, I would support anyone who is gay. I mean, that's got to be some part of the battle is, man, if I do this, my career may be, I am the gay football player, you know, and that's kind of... As footballers, we want to be known, like I've said, by our stats, and I'm a great tackler, I can finish, you know, in the final third, but I'm not sure someone wants to have their career labeled as the first gay Premier League player. So, I guess, what do you think the media's influence, and how is it a huge effect on someone coming out?
Yeah, I think so, because the media will inevitably frame your story in a particular way. There's a presentation that goes with reporting. So whether that's a story that ends up on the front pages, whether it's you know, the way that you are written about in just in a match report going forwards, all those ways that we describe people and we talk about them, and inevitably it does come down to labels. And there's a lot of people are really, really worried about the labels. They don't want to be like put in the gay footballer bracket. Then again, there's no shame in being gay, so why would that necessarily be a bad thing? But, you know, we're still trying to get to that place. We haven't actually reached it yet, certainly not in football. And whether it's this whole idea of the media, in a way we're all the media now because we all use social media. So what's happened to Ruben Loftus-Cheek is that, you know, a silly rumor has begun by somebody who just wants to raise their profile or raise their Twitter account or platform or whatever it was by propagating daft rumors about footballers. And we see it quite often now because sadly that's the place we've got to. Football is behind the times, so people are going to try and use that in a way to do whatever they do, and it's daft behavior, but it goes on. You know, that obviously, like, Ruben Loftus-Cheek got to the point presumably where he felt, I kind of need to nip this in the bud, so I'll put a statement out there. And yeah, he phrased it in a way that was really good. I'm sure he maybe had a little bit of help with that from his team. You know, every Premier League footballer has a team of people behind them. And actually, that's really interesting in itself, just the way it was phrased. I mean, it was only less than a year ago that one of his Chelsea teammates, Michy Batshuayi, sort of had a similar incident, and he reacted in a way that wasn't as quite as supportive as the one that Ruben Loftus-Cheek put out. So I think you can see maybe there was an awareness of what had happened to Michy and what Ruben had done. So, yeah, it's all part of the developing kind of way that everyone is expected to handle these stories. And in the media, again, there's always going to be a tension between the sports pages and the front pages. So obviously here in Britain, we have a tabloid press that people in your country will be familiar with, the way that it operates. And maybe it's not quite as bad as it used to be, but there's still it's a huge commercial enterprise. So certain newspapers now in such a difficult climate are fighting to stay alive. Their circulation numbers are dropping. Print media is dying out and digital media is coming to the fore. So these businesses, they need to sell their product. So naturally they're going to have to try and put something on the front page that is going to pull in your casual buyer. And the way that the media works is sensationalism, gossip, conjecture, all these things. If you can put together a front page that you know, you're walking past a newsstand and it catches your eye and you think, oh, that's a hell of a story, and you might go and buy the newspaper that you would never normally buy, that's how that newspaper is going to stay alive. There's people's jobs that depend on that. So sadly, you know, we're in that space now, I think, where occasionally those stories are used and it's sport that drives those front pages. Is it a secret of a footballer who might be gay? We've had stories in the last 12 months about Premier League footballers who are bisexual with hush money homophobic bullying at Premier League clubs. And these things come around every few months and we have to react to it. And usually there's this kind of outpouring of, oh, are we still doing this like in 2019? Are we still presenting gay footballers in this way with silhouettes of their mystery people on front pages? And it is exasperating, but there's reasons why that happens. And it's not great journalism. It's lazy decision making at the top of those publications. But that's the position we've got ourselves in. So in order to move forward and get past that, we all need to be having much more kind of mature conversations about inclusion. Actually, it's interesting now, I think a lot of these tabloid newspapers that do run these stories, quite often you'll find inside they'll have an editorial bit of the newspaper where they put forward in very kind of worthy tones their reasons for putting this particular story on the front page. Or we're you know, so upset with the fact that homophobia is still so rampant in football that's why we're running this story today, because we need to show that football, you know, is a safe space for gay people and that this kind of thing shouldn't happen. But we put it on the front page because we know it's going to sell loads of newspapers. So, yeah. You know, the hypocrisy is so obvious and yet it perpetuates all the time. So, you know, the sooner we get those newspapers, those businesses being aware that even in their own newsrooms they have LGBT employees and who are, you know, upset by the fact that they're working for a publication that puts that kind of thing on the front page, you need those senior leaders, those decision makers and editors at the top to think, actually, let's not do this, because okay, it might give us a little spike in sales, but the negativity will outweigh that for us. It's not a win. Let's not do it.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with everything you just said, and I'm looking at the clock here, and I know John has to go soon because he's a busy guy.
Sorry.
So, no, it's quite all right. I just want to, again, last kind of shift here, focus more on, you know, broader terms. You've done some, or been able to attend some amazing events. I think you said it was the Kanifa tournament. You obviously go to Premier League matches all the time. What are some highlights for you as places or events you've attended and been like, wow, I cannot believe I'm at this? Or, and vice versa, what's an event you're looking at, man, I really want to be at that or be able to write about that as a sports journalist?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't get out to that many kind of big sporting events. The job I have is an office job, it's a desk job. You know, I'm not the reporter out in the field. That reporter is sending their stuff to me and I'm in the office. I mean, the sporting events that I love, I mean, football is my passion, you know. So, but actually, just watching my own team play now is more kind of I have to say that I haven't actually been that often this season. But you know, if my team's in an important game, I'd rather go and watch that than go and watch Arsenal or Chelsea or any other team. Not that I don't enjoy that as well, but you know, there's something about supporting your own team that's where you get into the game. That's where, you know, your emotions get really, really at fever pitch. The Kenefa tournament you mentioned, that was just a very kind of new organisation that's doing this kind of, trying to spread the game and the idea of how football crosses beyond borders and this kind of idea outside of FIFA. So FIFA being the huge kind of financial, like mega rich beast that it is, that dominates the world football. Actually, there's loads of places around the world that don't feel like they can be a part of FIFA because they're, you know, disputed territories or regions of countries and different kinds of international identities. So Kenefa was formed very much to like give those people an opportunity to kind of play football and meet each other on a global scale. And it's a very new organization, but I really love the kind of counterculture ethos of it. And I know some of the people involved and they're wonderful people and their intentions are very, very good. So I love the fact that Kenefa is something that is kind of growing and people are becoming more conscious of it. So yeah, your listeners, I would very much recommend they check out some of the stuff that they're doing. Yeah, and in terms of events that I'd love to go to, I love going to the States. I love coming to watch sport in the States, going to hockey games, basketball, all that kind of stuff. That kind of gets me excited. You know, I want to come over to Atlanta. I want to come see Atlanta United. I mean, the atmosphere looks amazing in that stadium, and that's very much on my list. Going to Tokyo maybe for the Olympics is something we've kind of talked about, so who knows.
Did you, I'm guessing you were covering the Olympics here, were you part of that?
So again, like, you know, I went to events, I went to like Olympic and Paralympic events, but I was working on football as my job. I wasn't covering Olympic sports, so again, I wasn't sent out to cover the games, but I went as a fan, yeah. Just like everyone else, I went to watch volleyball and rowing and sort of athletics in the stadium, and it was great. And that buzz of London 2012, that seems such a long time ago now, because as you'll know, this country is sadly going through some very turbulent times, and that togetherness and sense of unity that we had around London 2012 now seems to have evaporated sadly. And like in the States, the political climate just kind of does affect things like that, and we just don't feel together as a nation like we used to.
What are 5-10 years from now, where do you see sports journalism? Where do you see writing? I know we kind of talked about the death or dying of the physical product and going more digital. I mean, any other trends you think will happen in the next few years?
Trends that I think will happen in the next few years. It's difficult for me because I've only really ever worked in the digital media space. I've worked for Sky for a number of years, so I'm quite indoctrinated into the kind of the Sky way of doing things. So my journalism and the way that we operate is very much in line with our broadcast channels. So, you know, we will produce a lot to support the rights that we have. So we want people to watch sport on Sky, feel a part of the game, whatever the sport they love. Recently, we started televising and we've become the UK's NBA broadcaster here, so we've done a lot more in terms of our digital coverage of NBA and basketball and trying to bring those personalities to a British audience like LeBron and Stephen Curry and all these guys. So that's been really exciting. I think I'm beginning to sense that obviously a younger audience that's coming through, they are a little bit more scattergun sometimes in their approach. They like to like latch onto a particular personality. You can see sort of the cult that is around like someone like Cristiano Ronaldo, what have you. Obviously, they are passionate about their teams as well, but, you know, we have really elevated the individual to like iconic status. And again, like what I'm very much, and it's something that we talked about a little bit earlier today, but athlete activism and athletes using their platforms for social causes, for social change. We've seen so much of it in the States with Colin Kaepernick and Serena and Stephen Curry and people like that. I think, you know, that's something that I want to be more of in British sport. Here we have really high profile individuals in the Premier League and in football who are presumably really, really nice guys, but they're just sanitized to the point of, so we don't really know what they really think. They have social accounts that are very kind of micromanaged, and it's, you don't really have that connection. So I want people to kind of feel passionate about something, whether it's to change the world or make things better for someone who's at a disadvantage. You know, maybe they can be more adept at communicating that message and actually, you know, doing what they're there to do, which is to play their sport and to be brilliant at that, but also to say, you know, let's shine the light on this particular issue.
I think that's a great way to kind of end it. I will say, though, so I play for the Minnesota Grey Ducks, which is an LGBTQ team in Minnesota, and there's been very small discussions about maybe doing a England trip where we would go around and play, you know, London Titans, Stonewall, hopefully Charlton, Invicta, kind of do like a week, 10-day kind of tour playing LGBTQ teams. So if that comes about, I hope you can cover it and maybe do a little piece on it. But still a lot of work in progress, but I think that'd be fun.
That'd be awesome, and yeah. I would definitely cover that. That sounds really exciting. You'd have to go to Glasgow, play Edinburgh, play Hot Scots, which up there in Scotland. There's the teams in Cardiff and, you know, all around the country. I'm sure they'd be delighted to host you. So yeah, you'd have a lot of people clamoring for the tour to come to their town.
John, can you please share your Twitter, definitely, but any other kind of social media that you want to share with your listeners?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. I'm at JohnBoy79, so JohnBoy79. Sky Sports, who I work for. If you go to skysports.com/rainbowlaces, you can find the archive of all our LGBT and sport inclusion content. There's a whole range of stuff there, particularly the Rainbow Laces campaign that we had last November, December time. There's still a lot of great content there that you can consume. If you're interested in the network, Sports Media LGBT Plus, we also have a website and a Twitter account. Just search for Sports Media LGBT and you'll find that. And yeah, there's great ways to connect if you're in the industry or if you're just in sport and you want to kind of broaden your network or your connections, then drop us a line. We do kind of regular emails. We partner with other organizations. We had a big event that we did at the BBC in October. That was our first event, so we were hoping to do something again this year. Yeah, so there's lots of different ways to get in touch, but as always, you know, do please drop me a DM or an email, and if you've got anything you want to work on or just get some advice on, I'd be happy to help.
Yeah, guys, John is amazing. So if you have any thoughts, anything, reach out to him. He's great. But thank you so much for your time. I know you're super busy.
You're very welcome, and it's been a pleasure.
Thanks.
I want to thank everybody again for giving this podcast an opportunity and for also giving me part of your day. I really enjoyed interviewing with John, as he is a great colleague of mine and he's really a mentor to me. And I just really encourage you guys to follow his work and keep an eye out on all the things that John is doing. If you liked the episode, feel free to subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening from. And please, please, please give us a good rating and review. Also, just another reminder, please like and follow us on all of our social media channels, which will be posted in the episode description. I'm your host, Adam McCabe, and I look forward to next time. Cheers.